Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello there. How are you? I thought I would report to work this morning. Happy Monday morning to you. Patrick Madrid here. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, just to give them proof of life, say something so they know you're okay. So they don't ask.
Something. It's early Monday.
Yeah. Surely, you know, something else you could say.
Yeah. Did you have any money in that bank that collapsed?
Oh, my gosh. I did not. But I've been watching the headlines for the last 24 hours on this bank collapse, the Silicon Valley Bank. And I don't claim to really understand a lot of the inner workings of such things, but we're keeping an eye on that because it seems to be affecting a lot of other banks. So if it becomes more of a story than it already is, we'll certainly keep you up to date. How about you? Did you lose any money in that?
No, I've been following it on Twitter and any kind of news source I can get my hands on. It's really interesting, and there's just a lot I don't understand about it. Part of me is like, oh, just they're going to bail out all these people again, and you know, it's going to be the poor people that pay for all these rich people to be bailed out. And then the other side of me is like, there's people that have jobs and they're on a payroll, and all these people that work for like Roku's one of the big ones. They have $245 million in this bank, and it's gone. It was just gone. And think of all the employees and the people that are feeding their families, and they have mortgages and rent, and a kid has braces, and they're just living paycheck to paycheck. And
yeah, car payment.
I don't understand how a bank falls like that in the first place. And they're like, this is the biggest collapse since 2008. And I was like, that wasn't that long ago. It's too soon for another collapse.
Sound animated about this.
Well, I have conflicting emotions about it, and I think it's interesting, and I think it's big. And
yeah,
like what happens to all these smaller banks, and then and all of these tech companies that have money invested in a bank like this, and those tech companies are going to make a run on the bank today when the money opens up. But it just seems like a way for bigger corporations like Google and Apple to eat up these small tech companies that are just getting their foot in the ground.
Now, I mean, do you have an opinion on this issue? Do you have any strong feelings about it one way or the other?
All right. Oh, I forgot. It's a Patrick Madrid show. All right. Let's go.
I'm fascinated. I am fascinated.
I don't know. I was really curious to see what you thought about it.
Well, honestly, and I'm being completely candid here, I don't understand the financial machine well enough to really know what to think of it. I know it's bad, and it seems to be, from everything that I can read and to the extent that I understand what I'm reading, it's bad for a lot of people, like you said, not just the small guy, but also for other companies and even big. I'm looking at something here this morning about how the British tech sector is feeling the effects of this all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. That was one of the headlines on, Drudge Report, I guess. So I don't know. I really don't know what to make of it. I look to the people who are experts on such things to see what they think about it. And we'll see. We'll keep an eye on this story as it goes. Hopefully it won't get any worse than it is now. That's my hope. Well, off to the races. 888-914-9149 is the number to call to be on the program. 888-914-9149. I have a note that came in this morning. This is from Anonymous, and Anonymous is writing from Green Bay, listening on our 1050 AM station. And Anonymous says, I have a friend who has gone to mystics and fortune tellers in the past. She has also used tarot cards. I have warned her about the dangers of these things. However, she will still sometimes talk to people, I would consider them mystics, who advise her on things regarding her life, such as ask the universe. She will say things like, my friend Tina gets the feeling that living in Denver will be good for me for a while. but that eventually I will move on to my permanent home. Or she will say, my friend Tina says that my body should avoid eating venison because it doesn't agree with me at this time. All of this information is coming from the unknown, not from any scientific source. Am I correct in being skeptical about this? Well, my one question I have is her friend Tina an imaginary friend who talks to her, or is this friend Tina an actual person? That's one question. And certainly if this is an imaginary friend, well, I'm pretty confident that this is not a good angel. So the only other possibilities would be its own her own imagination, which is possible, or it could be a demonic entity, also possible. So Anonymous concludes by saying, if I discourage her from talking to these types of people, she will bring up Catholic mystics and say that there's no difference between her quote-unquote gifted friends and Catholic mystics. How do I address the issue with her? I just want to protect her. Well, I could see why you'd want to protect her. What you've done thus far, it makes a lot of sense to me, telling her that it's dangerous, to say the least, to be dabbling in the occult, tarot cards, fortune tellers, so-called mystics, etc. Stay far away from them. Now, perhaps the problem is that she's using the word mystic in a way different from how the Catholic Church uses the term, at least when we talk about those who are given private revelation. So there are plenty of people out there who call themselves mystics, or they would like other people to call them mystics, who are not. They are just people with vivid imaginations and maybe some cunning, perhaps. And this has happened before, where people have turned out to not be anything at all mystical in an authentic sense. They're not getting any apparitions from God. Some are authentic, but I would say those are far and few between. Those who style themselves as mystics are a dime a dozen. And for that one reason, the term mystic is probably maybe not as helpful as it might have been, you know, in another context. But the reason I say that is because just because somebody acts in a mystical way or says mystical things doesn't mean that he or she is a mystic. So the best thing, if you ask me, is to continue giving her these well-placed warnings, these well-meaning warnings, that this is, as I put it, the devil's doorbell. And if you ring the doorbell, he's going to open the door. And he's going to invite you in. And a lot of people don't realize that that's what's happening when they go down this path into the occult. You might want to get her a book that I've recommended on the program before. This is by Father Cliff Ermatinger. And where did it go? I had it here. Well, wouldn't you know, I had it here Friday afternoon here in the studio, but I don't see it right now. So it's a book that he wrote, taking the theology of St. John of the Cross and looking at how the devil will try to get in your way and mess things up for you at the various stages of spiritual growth. So it sounds like she's not even maybe at the most beginner level of spiritual growth if she's dabbling in these things. So maybe during the break, if it's been put elsewhere in the studio, I'll find it and I'll tell you what the title of the book is so that you can maybe give her a copy. I think that could be very helpful for her. You can also give her a book on hell and say all of these things that she's dabbling in have nothing to do with true mysticism. The true mystics of the church are focused on God and the things of God. They're not focused on trying to conciliate hidden powers, as the Catechism puts it, and try to manipulate knowledge or other people or gain power over things or future events, things of that nature. None of those things have anything to do with authentic Christianity. So the book on hell, you can see a picture of it if you want. It's at the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on links, and then you can see a link for this book on hell. It was written in the late 19th century by a Jesuit priest, and the book is called The Dogma of Hell. And the reason I recommend it as often as I do is because it's a great tonic for people who have deluded themselves, and they think that this is pretty hunky-dory. I can communicate with spirits and go to fortune tellers, and they tell me things about my future. And you'll notice how ambiguous this talking Tina friend of hers is. It might be a good thing for you to go to Denver for a while, but eventually you want to move on. How utterly ambiguous. That could be said about anyone at any time. So her talking Tina friend doesn't sound like somebody she should be paying attention to. So check out that book on hell. Maybe give her a copy of it. Yeah, I've known other people who have been scared straight as a result of reading that. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ellie in Naples, Florida. Good morning, Ellie. Welcome. Hello, Ellie. Ellie's not ready. All right, we'll see if we can't get Ellie ready. In the meantime, let's go to Steve in Riverside. Good morning, Steve. There we go. Okay. Sorry, Steve, start over.
Hi there. I attended my first Latin Mass on accident during traveling in Fresno, California. I wanted to ask you, I was kind of underwhelmed by the whole experience. Were early people for hundreds and hundreds of years supposed to be exposed to learning how to be a Christian or how to get to know God through his word? And even if they weren't going to hear the Bible necessarily directly in their native language, how were they supposed to get exposed to the distillation of its teachings through church teaching, et cetera, like that?
Well, there were many ways. One would be the preaching, so the sermon that the priest would give. That's one way. Another way in medieval times was the stained glass windows that would depict Bible scenes for the benefit of the great majority of people who couldn't read. That was the purpose of stained glass windows back then. And so those educated the people. There were many ways, but those are two, at least as far as being at Mass is concerned. Many of the people who were there, even if they didn't know Latin to speak it freely, they were sufficiently familiar with it to know what was being said, things like that.
I was going to say, how would they know? Pretend me and you were like an Aztec convert, you know, and the Spaniards came and, you know, we were, you know, supposed to give up our faith. And, you know, now the new sacrifice was the sacrifice of the Mass. The Mass I attended, it didn't even have a homily. In fact, I couldn't even hear the priest. He was basically whispering the entire time, like the entire time.
It was on. It's called a low Mass. That's why you didn't hear him say much of anything other than when he would turn toward the congregation and say, Dominus vobiscum, and everybody would respond, et cum spiritu tuo. So it sounds to me like you were present at a low Mass, and it's called a low Mass because the priest speaks in a low voice. And so by design, you're not hearing the prayers. You hear what the altar servers say in response. That's another way. Yeah, it's a very different kind of Mass than what you're accustomed to, Steve, but it was the Mass that nourished the lives of countless great saints. I mean, think of all the great saints that you can name. All of them, with the exception of maybe some that were alive in the 20th century, all of them came to sanctity through that Mass, in the Latin Rite of the Church anyway. So it historically has been a great font of sanctity, I guess is the right word for it. And even if it's not something that you felt drawn to, countless other people do, and countless other people have benefited from it. I don't know what to tell you as far as like what would be the ways in which you personally could like it more. Maybe it's something if you went more than once, and perhaps if you didn't have a negative bias toward it. I don't know if you do. Some people do. But if you were willing to let it sink into your mind, that might be another way to find out. But I mean, the Mass is what it is, and it has done a great job for countless people thus far. So I'm sorry that you didn't have a good experience with it, but that's okay. The church is big enough.
Well, I was just grateful for the fact that the new form of the Mass is there. I honestly don't even know if I would have converted to Catholicism almost a decade ago if that was my experience I walked into. And I can totally see why, you know, Protestants might object and try and, you know, change the form of the liturgy a little bit. And I'm grateful the church has, you know, adapted the liturgy so that people like myself could, you know, hear God's word and, you know, learn that way. I don't know how your average Aztec convert was supposed to learn how to be Christian if he wasn't learning it directly in church.
You know what's funny about that, Steve? You mentioned Aztec converts twice now. When Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared to Juan Diego, who himself, by the way, attended the Latin Mass, this is not quite 500 years ago. In that space of time, in roughly a decade or so after the apparition, over 10 million, some number as high as 11 million, Aztecs converted to the Catholic faith, and that was the Mass that they attended. St. Juan Diego was an Aztec, and he went to that mass. And, I mean, you know the story, I'm sure. But it's interesting that you reference them, because there was a vast number of conversions among the Aztecs, and it was precisely in the context of the traditional Latin mass. Isn't that interesting?
It is inspiring. One thing that's concerned me is syncretism I've encountered within Catholicism, and I can't help but feel like that particular mass is fertile ground for syncretism to occur. If people say aren't learning about, you know, the Christian faith, and they don't know anything, and, you know, they're just sitting in a sanctuary, not sure what's going on, and meanwhile there's a statue of Saint Joseph over there, well, why not just hide our previous practices while, you know, the priest is doing his own thing? Do you see what I'm wondering about?
I do. I mean, I don't concur with you. I don't think that your argument is persuasive, but I could understand why somebody might look at it that way. I could see what you're saying, but I don't know if you can see what I'm saying, and that is the thought experiment that you're laying out has been conducted over the space of, let's say, 1,500 years in countless great saints, men, women, boys, and girls, martyrs, missionaries, scholars, bishops, holy men and women, married folk, all of the above have been nourished at the font of the traditional Latin Mass. And countless converts to the faith. Look at the phenomenal results that the Jesuits were having, for example, in Asia, in places like the Philippines and China and Korea and Japan. Had it not been for the crackdown from, for example, in Japan, where the shoguns cracked down on the Catholic missionaries because they thought their culture was being subverted by the West as a result of the Catholic missionary efforts. Had it not been for some of those crackdowns, it's entirely possible that China could be like the Philippines is in terms of primarily Catholic. And my point about raising those issues is those Jesuit missionaries who were preaching and teaching the faith among these people in Asia, they had great success, and it was the traditional Latin Mass that they were celebrating for them. If you want to see another example, which is a Hollywood version, Steve, take a look at the movie The Mission. And it depicts, in a somewhat historically inaccurate way, but it depicts the Jesuit missionaries in Uruguay and Paraguay in the 1700s. And it's astonishing. Here again, the traditional Latin Mass is what they evangelize the people with, and it's astonishing in the reductions, or the reducciones, that they built, similar to the California missions. The very high achievements of the native peoples in music and art and all kinds of other things that had nothing to do directly with Christianity, but they were zealous converts, zealous followers of Jesus. And that would be another example of where, what mass did they have? They had the traditional Latin Mass, and it certainly worked for them.
Well, I do agree it was quite beautiful. I can tell the people who were there were quite devout, you know, and that is inspiring, and I'm sure it's created great saints. I just wonder, because not everyone is so awesome when it comes to religious practice. Your common man is just an average guy who might go to church once a week if he's lucky. And so I was just wondering how people learned to be a Christian, if necessarily it wasn't done directly through the Mass. And obviously the church requires classes and stuff. I was just curious what, during history, what formation people had who were converts.
A lot of it was, not to be repetitive here, but a lot of it was the preaching. So preaching was very important, and the preaching would be in the native language of the people. So even if they couldn't understand Latin or much Latin, the explanation and the preaching on the scriptures would be, I think, probably the main bulwark in that area. Stained glass windows, is as odd as it sounds, that too was very didactic for people to see these biblical scenes. That was helpful to them. And then to the extent that any of them were able to get any sort of education, typically in Europe anyway, that would come from the monks in the monasteries who would educate people who were able to go. Most people couldn't. So it was certainly a simpler time, as the saying goes, and they didn't have access to all the resources that we have today. But you know what's interesting, Steve? I've got to run, but I appreciate your call. I'll leave you with this thought. Isn't it interesting that in those days, with so few resources, no websites, no radio shows, the church throve and countless saints came out of the church, thank God. Countless sinners did too. But now, with all of our resources, isn't it interesting how relatively unacquainted with the faith people are nowadays? We're trying to change that here at Relevant Radio. Thanks, Steve. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. Yeah. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Yeah. Relevant Radio.
All right, let's do this thing. Let's go to Megan now in Austin, Texas. Good morning, Megan. Welcome.
Good morning. I've called in before, and I live in Austin, Texas. And there is a large, you know, occult presence here, but in a large tech presence. And I feel, even though regular people will be affected by it, I felt immediately a little relieved that the Silicon Valley Bank going under, just because there's such a presence of, I guess, atheists, or people feel like they are God by building a new, better human with gene editing and artificial intelligence and singularity, combining robotics with human beings so you could program them. So they're playing God here. And I think God's kind of saying, yeah, right. You know, kind of just like it takes such little effort for God to kind of stop them in their tracks and remind them that they're human and God is in charge. You know, and then Elon Musk is talking about buying it. He's creating a new city right next to us. So, you know, I'm kind of grateful for it. It's kind of stopping them in their tracks a little bit. And I don't think it's a bad thing.
Well, fair enough. And I'm not disagreeing with you per se, Megan. There's a lot that you just talked about, transhumanism and other things. Have you ever read the book, The Singularity is Near, by Ray Kurzweil? That ring a bell?
Yes, it does ring a bell. I haven't read it, but I know.
Okay. I would recommend that people read it, especially people of faith. You should read that book. It came out maybe 12 years ago or thereabouts. And he's a high up guy in Google, and he's an evolutionary. He takes an evolutionary approach to not just life, but also to technology. And the essence of the book is that technology, as it speeds up, the computing power gets faster, and it also gets smaller. So the miniaturization is a big part of this as well. And he just kind of graphs out how this is now moving into, and already is now, in a place where the advances are happening so quickly, and then even more quickly, and then more quickly, now with artificial intelligence really boosting that. His theory is really also his goal, and that is to see transhumanism occur, in which there is a wholesale merger between human biology and technology, so that at first, in the form of, say, nanotechnology, little molecular-sized machines that can be introduced into your body to clear plaque out of your arteries or to improve your eyesight by eliminating cataracts and things of that nature. Eventually, what he is saying is there will be, and should be, in his view, not in my view, a merger between technology and humanities, to the point where what you and I think of as human beings will be antiquated, because human beings in the future will possess fantastical abilities and knowledge because of the introduction of technology into the body. Now, I'm probably grossly oversimplifying the point that he's making, and I don't agree with the premise that he approaches this from, but that's, I think, what he describes in that book 10, 12, 15 years ago is what we're seeing now. So he is prescient in that regard. And to the extent that the banks that are funding this kind of thing take a hit, I can see where ideologically, like with this Silicon Valley Bank, ideologically, it's like, yeah, let's stick it to those people who are trying to merge us with robots, that kind of thing. But what about all the people who have to pay their mortgage and put their kids into school and feed their families and make their payments and things? It seems to me that the real danger here is all of the common people who are going to be badly hurt as a result of this. Ideologically, maybe it serves them right, you know, the people on the corporate boards and the decision makers and how the money is spent, but they're not going to be hurt by this. I mean, sure, they'll take a hit on paper, but they'll still have the nice homes and the nice cars and things, but it's the vast number of working people who are going to get hurt, or so it seems to me. What do you think, Megan?
Oh, sorry about that. I have it done. You know, you're absolutely right. I think it's always a battle between Satan and God. And I, in my prayer life, I've been a lot of, the answer I'm always getting is, you know, trust me, and I don't have to, you know, try to figure it out, and just trust that God, of course, will win this, however it ends up. So I don't know. And I agree with what you're saying. You know, my own father, he's in the defense industry for drones. He's a Catholic, and he has a lot of conflict with contributing to wartime efforts. But I think at the end of the day, God knows us better than we know ourselves. And that whatever happens, there's a lot of evil things that happen in this world, but we still keep the faith. I don't know what's going on, and sometimes I'm afraid, but that's where my faith comes in.
That's right. That's the best way to look at it. Put first the kingdom of God, and everything else will be added unto you. That's what Jesus said. And it sounds so simple, and it really is simple. It's just not easy to do when you're surrounded by all these distractions and all these, you know, things that are screaming at you from the headlines. Look at this, believe in this, be afraid of this kind of thing. And Jesus says, you know, only one thing is necessary. Love God with all your heart, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And as the world turns, if you're doing that, doesn't really matter what happens in the world, you're going to be okay.
And I wanted to add something. I'm Lakota on my mom's side, and sure, and we didn't a lot of, and I'm grateful for the missionaries, because a lot of our cultures have to do with blood sacrifice. And I think it didn't have to take much for people to hear the message of Christ, because it's such good news, and truth just has a way of ringing in our soul. I think it's a pretty nice alternative when people are compared the two. And I think that's going to happen in the tech industry too. I think people are going to look at the soulless robotics and how everything gets sort of messed up. And then they're going to see, we have a natural hunger and thirst for God. So I just hope that, and I pray, and I know he's going to take care of us, and I don't know how, but I hope that, you know, our human hunger for God, it'll be enough in comparison to that world, because it surely didn't take much for Aztecs to say, oh, I'd rather that Jesus Christ is the last sacrifice, and we don't have to like throw our children into fires or anything anymore. So I think it's kind of a easy sell.
In that sense, sure. Yeah. I mean, if your option is between Moloch and something way, 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 way better, I understand what you mean. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate that, Megan. I appreciate that very much. Awesome. One interesting thing, in kind of tangential to what Megan was saying, and also referring to a caller earlier who did not enjoy his experience at the traditional Latin Mass. Phyllis writes in, she's listening in Mount Holly, New Jersey. Thanks for the note, Phyllis. She says, at 88 years of age, I certainly understood the Mass as a child and what was going on. I had a missal which had Latin on one page and English on the opposite side. All you had to do was read. She says, so sad that people find that a problem. Well, fair enough, and I understand where you're coming from, Phyllis. It's actually one of the points I should have mentioned but didn't, so I'm glad you did, and that is that if you had your missal, you knew exactly what was happening by knowing from the missal what the priest was saying and so on. I should have had the presence of mind to mention that, but I'm glad you did. Thank you. 888-914-9149. This leads me to, I want to share with you something. We talked about the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, or maybe the government is preventing it from collapsing. We'll see what happens. But this is an interesting article came out yesterday in the New York Post. A head of risk management at Silicon Valley Bank spent considerable time spearheading multiple woke LGBTQ programs, including a safe space for coming out stories, as the firm catapulted toward collapse. Jay Ursapa, the boss of financial risk management at SVB, that's Silicon Valley Bank, the one that's in the news right now, this is in the UK, their branch in the UK, was launching initiatives such as the company's first month-long Pride campaign. And by the way, remember that pride is the chief of the deadly sins. A month-long Pride campaign and a new blog emphasizing mental health awareness for LGBTQ youth. Oh, I forgot the plus. I'm sorry, LGBTQ plus youth. We don't know yet what the plus entails. I suppose we'll find out in due time. So Ursapa said, the phrase "you can't be what you can't see" resonates with me. This is on the company website. As a queer person of color and a first-generation immigrant from a working-class background, there were not many role models for me to see growing up. Her efforts at the company's European LGBTQIA+ employee resource group co-chair earned her a spot on Silicon Valley Bank's outstanding LGBT+. They keep going back and forth. In some places, it's LGBTQIA+. Then they just shorten it to LGBT+. What about the QIA people? I'm not entirely sure who they are, but what about them? Why are you leaving them out? That's judgmental. She was on the LGBT plus role model list 2022, a list shared in a company's post just 4 months before the bank was shut down by federal authorities over liquidity fears. In addition to instituting SVB's first safe space catch-up, which encouraged employees to share their coming out stories, and serving on LGBTQ plus panels around the world, Ursapa also spent time over the last year serving as a director for diversity role models and volunteering as a mentor for migrant leaders. I thought this was a bank. I thought that's like, you know, banking stuff is what they're supposed to do. She says, I feel privileged to co-chair the LGBTQ plus ERG. I'm drowning in acronyms here, Cyrus. I don't even know what half of these things mean. She's spreading awareness of lived queer experiences. She partners with charitable organizations, and above all, she creates a sense of community for our LGBTQ plus employees and allies.
Right.
Now, you know what's interesting, Cyrus? In the article, it says that she, Ursapa, couldn't be reached for comment. That's weird. SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, was abruptly shut down on Friday by the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation shortly after it disclosed it had taken a $1.8 billion hit from a $21 billion fire sale of its bond holdings. It faced a cash crunch due to surging interest rates and a recent meltdown in tech sector. The tech sector led many customers to make a run on their deposits. Shares of SVB Financial, the bank's parent, plunged by a whopping 60% the day before. The stock was down by another 60% in pre-market trading Friday until it was halted. So maybe, I'm guessing perhaps part of the problem was they didn't keep their eye on the ball. And maybe they were spending too much time doing LGBTQ plus diversity nonsense, and they wound up not doing what they're supposed to do and what the shareholders expected them to do. That's my guess, if I had to guess. So there's that. Now, when we return, we're going to go back to your phone calls, 888-914-9149. That's the number to call to be on the program. But I also want to share with you, as long as we're on this general topic, there is a new policy for the Diocese of Baker, Oregon. And this is, I guess it's Baker Redmond. And this is the Catholic Diocese, and they have released a new transgender policy. And I'm going to read it to you. You don't want to miss this. I'll share with you what that is. Just came out. And we'll also post it so you can read it and share it if you wish. That'll be all happening, plus your phone calls on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, the Relevant Radio app. Go on, take money and run.
keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
I remember I forgot the name of the book, and I said, I know it's here in the studio somewhere. I just couldn't put my hand on it, and I found it. Here it is. This is the book I was mentioning about the devil. It's called The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life, St. John of the Cross's teaching on Satan's involvement at every stage of spiritual growth. And the author is Father Cliff Ermatinger. I know him. I once did a lecture tour in Germany, and he was involved in helping to arrange that. He's an American priest, and I think where is he located? He's in the upper Midwest somewhere. Maybe he's in the Twin Cities area. I don't know for sure. I kind of lost track of him, but real good guy, and this is a real good book, The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life, St. John of the Cross's teaching on Satan's involvement at every stage of spiritual growth. So that was the book I was trying to remember, and there it is. So let's go, before we get back to the phones, this is released in the last couple of days from the Diocese of Baker, and maybe technically of Baker/Redmond, Oregon. And it is a transgender policy that has been implemented for all parishes and employees and schools, etc., for this diocese. And I'm going to read it to you. So it's called A Body You Prepared for Me. That's the title of the document, Transgender Policy for the Diocese of Baker. In a remarkably short time, the radical transgender agenda has swept all before it, rapidly expanding its bureaucratic dominance in government, education, and medicine through a deluge of liberty-constricting regulations. Caught unprepared by this sudden onslaught, Catholic parents, pastors, principals, and administrators need clear, consistent standards to navigate these turbulent societal waters and guide those in their care to safe harbor. This statement of policy applies Catholic teaching on human sexuality and morality to the challenges gender theory presents to Catholic organizations and institutions in the Diocese of Baker. And by the way, if you just put a blank space there, this could easily and rightfully should be a template for the diocese of you fill in the blank, the diocese of whatever diocese you live in. That's my view of this. This policy provides authoritative guidance for handbooks, employee agreements, and training for key employees throughout the diocese. Under its guidance, the policy gathers church employees, volunteers, and people young or old who carry on the work of the church. It also includes all contracted vendors in their on-site contact with people in the care of the church. Scripture teaches that when the Son of God came into the world, he said to his Father, and this is in Hebrews 10, verse 5, "A body you prepared for me." Centuries before, a similar moment of self-recognition had provoked awe-filled praise from the psalmist, "My bones are not hidden from you, who formed my inmost being in my mother's womb. I am wonderfully made." Now this is citing Psalm 139. In the drama of the Gospels, the human body of the Word made flesh takes center stage, the tiny body of the baby, the transfigured body of the beloved Son, the crucified body of the King of the Jews, the risen body of the victor over death. The Son of God took flesh of the Virgin Mary and gave his body over to death to destroy death and raise our bodies to life. In the words of St. Paul, the Savior of the world came to be the Savior of the body. This is Ephesians 5, verse 23. As he set about healing and teaching and casting out demons, Jesus made the psalmist's amazement his own. And this is from Matthew 19. He says, "Let the children come to me and do not prevent them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." Mindful of their Savior's command, parents entrust their children to Catholic parishes and schools for formation in Christian teaching on the dignity of human life, the goodness of the human body, the sanctity of marriage, and the indispensable centrality of the family. They do not send their sons and daughters for indoctrination in radical transgender ideology that will prevent them from coming to the Lord. It is therefore necessary to draw distinctions. Catholics believe that our identity as male or female is an essential part of the divine plan for the human race to increase and multiply by the bodily coupling of men and women in marriage. From this one flesh union of husband and wife come forth their children, creatures of the Creator's love for them exactly as they are. The sooner children come to know that God loved them into existence to share his love forever, the more confidently they will accept and care for their bodies as the unrepeatable, irreplaceable gift they are, wonderfully intricately made in God's mysterious design. Nonetheless, in the aftermath of original sin, growing up is hard to do. To wrestle with our sexual identity, to wonder about the meaning of our maleness and femaleness, is an indispensable part of learning who we are as persons. For a statistically minuscule but deeply afflicted segment of the population, however, the uniquely personal experience of gender identification is soul-wrenchingly difficult to integrate with biological sex. In the face of such painful confusion, Christians recall the suffering embodied in Jesus. In his last hours, the body prepared for him was plunged into a bottomless abyss of public rejection, physical, emotional, political. Pilate condemned him. The soldiers stripped him, crowned him with thorns, spat upon him. Onlookers mocked him. Passers-by reviled him. God seemed to have abandoned him. But the abandoned one does not abandon us. Penetrating the darkest recesses of human loneliness, fear, and shame, the eternal Son stays true to his name, Emmanuel. When we are most alone, he is always God with us. He identifies himself with every human being as someone for whom he suffered and died. The misery gender dysphoria provokes leads transgender activists to draw the hard and fast conclusion that gender is a purely personal choice, intrinsically unconnected to biological sex. They emphatically insist on a single solution to the problem, unqualified, quote-unquote, affirmation of a person's experienced gender, quote-unquote, over and against his or her biological sex, along with active encouragement for the process of gender transition to its surgical conclusion. Those who hasten to disrupt natural sexual development pay no heed to the lifelong, life-limiting consequences medical mutilation sets in motion, and they are keen to deny parents any say in withholding it from their children. Such hyper-urgency greatly exaggerates the frequency of deep-seated gender confusion in the population and ignores its preponderantly transient nature in those adolescents it afflicts. That's a rather clunky phraseology. It's entirely accurate and precise, but let me just expand on what that's saying. That the frequency, as they say, of deep-seated gender confusion is not very frequent. Proportionate to the whole, they talk about the population here. So the percentage of people who do indeed experience this dysphoria is very small, to the point of being minuscule compared to the total population. And the second part about its preponderantly transient nature in those adolescents that it afflicts, it refers to how the science shows us through statistical research that out of the population that you might survey of adolescent children who do experience some sort of questioning or doubt or lack of certitude about who they are, male or female, most all of them grow out of that. It's a phase that some children go through, and those who do go through it, most of them, they find that it's just transient. It's a phase, in other words. Continuing, in the years before gender theory came to prominence, children who firmly believed themselves to be in the wrong sex were rare, 0.2% by one estimate. They are a rarity still, but their suffering is grievous and merits our compassion. To our great misfortune, however, we find ourselves in sharp disagreement over what true compassion calls for in their condition. Over 80% of children with severe gender identity distress resolve it in the course of puberty with psychological treatment or no treatment at all. They then resume normal development. In stark contrast, of children who receive gender affirmative care, only 3% see a positive outcome. Such evidence goes against the grain of gender theory's prescription for unprecedented social experimentation on children. As additional information emerges that further erodes its revolutionary rationale, Christians should not be surprised, for cellular-level science confirms what Scripture teaches: the biological basis of our sexual identity is beyond the reach of human ingenuity to alter. We have no power to undo God's original creative design when he made us in his image, for our sexual identity is not assigned to us at birth. It is given to us by God in the womb. Subsequent hormonal interventions alter nothing of a person's chromosomal-based sexual identity, nor can so-called sex change surgeries undo the sexuality of the person created male or female. Directly intending to change one's given bodily sex into a new one means intending to alter the unalterable. For while it is possible to distinguish sex from gender, it is not possible to separate gender from sex. What God has joined together, Jesus says in another context, man must not divide. So under the heading, Going Forward in Faith, Rules for the Road Ahead, the document says this: human sexuality comes as a gift from the Creator. Male and female, He created them, and the gift brings to light a clear behavioral norm. The biological sex of a person should provide the basis for all our interactions in Catholic parishes, organizations, and institutions. Under the section for public witness, Catholic institutions should not publicly call in question their Catholic identity by posting signage or symbols or by adopting programs or texts or practices that promote transgender ideology. Under the heading of role of parents, as the primary educators of their children, parents have a right to information about curricular materials and programmatic events that affect the sexual development of their children. Any parochial, organizational, or institutional documentation that requires the designation of a person's sex is to reflect that person's biological sex. No person may designate a quote-unquote preferred pronoun in speech or in writing, nor are parishes, organizations, or institutions to permit such a designation or use the plural they, them, their, instead of the singular she, her, hers, or he, him, his. Public speakers at church or school events should address people and refer to them with pronouns that are consistent with their biological sex. All persons must use the bathroom or locker room that corresponds to their biological sex. All persons are to follow sex-specific dress codes in accord with their biological sex. Another way of saying that, this is me speaking now, is men are not allowed to wear dresses, etc., etc. Even if you're Corporal Klinger from MASH, you're not allowed to. Under the heading Sports Extracurricular Activities, it says participation in sex-specific extracurricular activities at church or school must conform to the biological sex of the participants. Organizers will arrange overnight housing at camps, retreats, and young adult and youth gatherings in accord with the biological sex of the attendees. Under the heading of medication, a young person who takes puberty-blocking drugs chooses a path at odds with integral human development because the process of gender transition entails the rejection of the body as God's gift. The vast majority of children who artificially pause natural pubertal development in this way go on to take cross-sex hormones. Since this is a result we cannot support, neither can we approve the path that leads to it, nor the surgeries that follow from it. Therefore, young people entrusted to the care of the church may not take puberty-blocking drugs, even if self-administered, on parish property or at an off-campus parish activity, with the purpose of potential or actual gender reassignment. And here's the conclusion. We welcome non-Catholics to participate actively in our parish life, especially in Catholic schools. As experience elsewhere demonstrates, however, open hostility toward this policy or public defiance of church teachings that support it undermine our Catholic identity and contradict our institutional mission. Therefore, students and parents who profess or promote the transgender agenda in effect make the choice not to enroll in or to withdraw from a Catholic school. Let me reread that. If you, parent or you, student, if you display open hostility toward this policy that I'm reading to you or public defiance of the church teachings that support it, basically you are saying, in essence, I don't belong here. And you, in essence, are saying, I can't have my child here. The school will respect their decision. They will not be offered admission, or they will be asked to withdraw if they are already enrolled.
Bye-bye.
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 We do not expect everyone to agree with this policy, but we do count on our fellow citizens to respect our right to establish it in accord with our fundamental Catholic beliefs. It is important for all of us to remember that respect is a two-way street, a street that leads to peace in the city. That's from Most Reverend Liam Carey, the Bishop of Baker. And there you have it. Well done, Bishop Carey. Well done. I'll be right back.
Are we clear?